This is a Rain Man Spotlight interview with host Michael Flores.
Hey, how you doing, David?
Pretty good.
Good. All right. So right on the dot. Look at you. Punctual. I like it. Nothing wrong with that.
I do aim for punctuality.
All right. So thank you for joining us today. I know you must be extremely busy. There seems to be a lot of buzz around your name the last several months, having been directly connected with the marketing and promotion of Star Trek Discovery. That's got to make you feel good, the fact that you were directly connected to the promotion of a whole new Star Trek era, correct?
Absolutely. It was a real pleasure to work with the writers' room in developing ideas. They were very receptive to feedback that I had, which I sent in via my friend Kirsten Beyer, mm-hmm. who was the staff writer on the show during season one.
Yeah.
And they were just really great to work with. And as a result, I feel like I was involved at least tangentially in helping to make the show the best it could be.
I mean, and you're a man that's had his fair shares of fantastic successes. I know you've been writing for well over two decades.
I wouldn't go that far.
Hey,
I would
definitely say so. I mean, going through your bio, I mean, you definitely accomplished quite a bit. I mean, and you had a goal. It seems like you have come pretty close. And again, this is me based on stalking you and figuring out where you started and where you're at today.
Okay.
So do you start to feel a little bit of pressure being a part of something as big as this launch of this new series?
Absolutely. I would like to see that my book does well in the marketplace. I hope it represents the series well and is well received. I've been very pleased so far at the majority of the online fan response to the book.
Yeah.
Reviews have been generally positive.
Yep.
Overall tone of reviews on Amazon, for the most part, have been positive. There's always a few outliers who are complaining or give me one star because they think the book is overpriced, but I can't control that. But it was important to me that, you know, as the first book to come out under the Star Trek banner for Discovery, that it represent the show well, because I know that in the past, especially with shows like Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise, the first novels that were released under those series banners were not exactly the greatest match with their parent series in terms of tone,
right?
In terms of capturing the characters' voices. And part of the reason for that was that on those earlier series, there wasn't this level of coordination between a writer's room and the tie-in program. Mm-hmm. The two were very separate. There was almost a firewall between them back in the 90s. And as a result, the only thing that writers back in those days had to work from very often was a series Bible, a writer's director's guide.
Right.
And maybe the first script of the series, if they were lucky. If they were lucky, they got that much material to work with. And from that, they would either have to novelize the pilot or write a first original novel based on the series. And part of the problem is that between a first draft of a pilot, and especially from when the series Bible is put together on those shows, which can be months before they actually write a script.
Okay.
So many changes occur in the writer's room and during revision of scripts, and then during the shooting of the episodes as they revise on set to reflect the reality of what actors are comfortable with, what lines do or do not sound right coming from which actor. As those things happen and the revisions occur, that information never makes it to the tie-in writer in most cases.
Yeah.
So the tie-in writer is making their best educated guess, but you just can't nail everything.
Yeah.
In contrast to that, what we had going on with Discovery was a far more fluid working relationship where I was involved from day one as they began developing story and talking about where they wanted things to go. They did not have a series Bible per se. They had some concepts that they were working with. And then beyond that, the rest of it was just developed as they went along in terms of story and script.
Okay.
And then I would see each revision on every script. I would see the revised pages that would come in every day as they were rewriting on set.
Oh, okay.
So I had a very good sense of how it was evolving, how it was changing. I would look at the changes they would make to a certain character's dialogue, and I would begin to see patterns. And I would say, okay, so-and-so apparently is not comfortable with long patches of dialogue. They're right. shortening this person's lines. This person's going to have a shorter, more direct way of speaking. Okay. I should adjust their dialogue to reflect that. Or this person tends to go for the 50-cent word. Go for the 50-cent words when you write this character.
Yeah.
And so on.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those things where, and I would catch things. I would see stuff in the scripts, like I'd say, well, that's an error of science. I should flag that. That's a Star Trek continuity error. I should flag that. And I would flag them, and I would send emails to Kirsten, and Kirsten would walk them into the room and go, hey, guys, Dave Mack found a couple of things. What can we do about this and this and this? And about half of them got fixed, and the other half, either they said, well, you know, we prefer our way. And sometimes they would say, well, it seems like an error, but it's not, because we're going to explain it. We're going to do this, but he doesn't know that yet.
Okay.
And so I would get feedback from Kirsten saying, they said, don't worry about this. They're fixing those. And they said, pound sand on that one. They like their way better. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
So there it is.
How much creative freedom would you say you had with narrative decision? Were there areas that they said, yes, you have free rein to do this, but hey, hold back here?
No, I was never really given what you would call free rein. And that's typical when writing media tie-ins of any kind. There is the whole nature of media tie-in writing, where you're playing with someone else's copyrighted material,
yeah.
is that you are playing with someone else's toys, and you have to play by their rules, mm-hmm, and you have mm-hmm. to put the toys back where you found them in most cases. The difference here was that because I was working with them during the development phase, I was able to say, well, what kind of story do you want me to tell? What kind of a story makes sense to have as the first tie-in novel that's going to be debuting, you know, days after the premiere of the show? So it's got to complement and fit with the show as it's rolling out.
Yeah.
What do you guys want? And we had a couple of false starts at the outset, where they steered me down a couple of paths, where they said, well, we would like to do this, or we would like you to do that. And for whatever reason, the first two story ideas that we tried to explore for the book just did not pan out, because they were changing their assumptions, changing their ideas in the room about what the show was going to be, who the characters were going to be,
right.
what their relationships were all going to be. And as that kept changing, and I kept trying to keep up, eventually they would change so much, I'd say, well, then this idea is no longer workable.
Yeah.
If we do this, we're going to box ourselves into a corner. And some of the other problems were that I think on the first two iterations of story idea that we tried to do for the book, they would have involved stories from the youth of Michael Burnham, her youth on Vulcan,
right.
Either as a child or as a teenager. And the problem we ran into with that is that when you make that story choice, like it or not, when your protagonist is a child or a teenager, no matter how you style the story itself, what you're writing is a YA story. You're writing YA fiction.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep.
YA meaning, for your listeners who don't understand that term, that means young adult. It's
right.
a subsection of science fiction and fantasy that tends to have tween and teenage protagonists.
Right.
And it tends to be marketed toward a teenage audience and not an adult audience.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized that we wanted this book to be marketed at an adult audience.
Yeah.
Just as the show was being marketed to an adult audience.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so eventually we had to abandon the notion of entire books set during Michael Burnham's youth, at least for the first book in the series. It's not that we said these ideas don't work or that they're bad ideas. It was that it wasn't where we wanted to plant our flag with book one.
Yeah. It wasn't your target demo.
We came up with an idea that we liked for book one. Just very general, it was a request from Brian Fuller. He asked me to write a novel that would team up the Shenzhou, the Starship Shenzhou and its mm-hmm. crew, prior to the pilot, with the Enterprise under the command of Captain Pike.
Yeah.
That was what he wanted. And that was the whole request. He said, just can you build a story out of that? And I said, well, of course I can build a story out of that. And I immediately went to work developing a story. And everything that flowed beyond that was me. I came up with the whole pitch, the whole concept of the story, the creature under the seabed, the ancient Turanian dynasty, the colonists who are keeping a secret.
Yeah.
And I intuited that the reason for this request was that Brian wanted me to put Michael and Spock together.
Right.
I could tell that that was the entire reason, the entire motivation for this request. So I made that an essential component of the story. And in the end, it's really about the whole book is about misunderstandings, misconceptions. It's about overcoming our errors of judgment, overcoming our own biases, and getting past them and learning to understand others the way we want to be understood ourselves.
Right.
It's interesting that you actually bring up that the whole story revolved around Burnham and Spock. But one of the things that really stood out for myself when I read your book was the parts that dealt with Captain Georgiou dealing with Captain Pike. And I really enjoyed, mm-hmm. I really enjoyed your rendition of Captain Pike. And I was like curious to see, what did you draw on for Pike? Because we all know that Pike is not a very well-known figure in Star Trek. Yeah, he's in the pilot. He's in the very first Star Trek. But there's not a lot of stuff that's been done. How did you draw on that character and actually make him come out really well in this book?
Well, I mean, some fans have felt like my characterization of Pike is at odds with, say, the one that was developed by I believe it was Margaret Wander Bonanno in her novel Burning Dreams. Mm-hmm. But my take on Pike, having watched The Cage several times over the years, and then also to a lesser degree, having watched Bruce Greenwood and his interpretation of Pike in the recent Bad Robot films, is that Pike, at least when he's a younger man in command of the Enterprise, when he's a young starship captain, the take I came away from in The Cage is that although he would prefer to be a scientist, a diplomat, and an explorer first, on some level, he knows that he is a soldier.
Right.
And that he has certain obligations to fulfill as a military officer. And he takes them very seriously. He is, in many regards, a by-the-book officer. And we could see that when the Talosians take Pike captive in the cage, that there's a lot of anger. There is a deep-rooted core of anger and violence in Pike that he works to keep under control, that he is very reluctant to let slip from, you know, its reins. But it's definitely there. There is a part of him that is capable of doing terrible things if that's what the job calls for.
Right.
And part of that is just I wouldn't call it the arrogance of youth, but there is a certain lack of empathy sometimes in youth where you're so headstrong and you're so certain you're right, even though you have limited life experience to draw upon, that you are prepared to make very rash and destructive choices with a great degree of moral certainty that would not be there if you had to make the same choice 20 years later with the benefit of wisdom and hindsight. And that's where Georgiou comes in. And part of the contrast I was looking to create between Georgiou and Pike is that in many respects, Georgiou is more like Picard in that she is an older officer. She's more experienced. She has been through war and combat. She has lost people. And because of that, she has come to appreciate what a terrible thing violence and war are. And so she works extra hard to find the nonviolent solution, to find the diplomatic answer, the scientific answer, before she will resort to weapons. Whereas Pike is a lot more like Kirk when he's younger. He is a by-the-book officer. He is very soldierly in his approach. And if he is given an order, you know, carry out General Order 24, for instance, well, that's the order. You get the order, you carry out the order. Just as Kirk very often, you know, said, I mean, Kirk has this reputation in fandom as this maverick who was always bucking orders and violating the Prime Directive. But if you go back and watch the original series, you find that that is not really true. That's a reputation that's more the result of a few moments in the movies, and that they actually represent an aberration in the career of James Kirk.
Yeah.
What made those moments stand out and become so iconic in the films is that they were so out of character, and that it was because Jim Kirk had been pushed to the limit by the death of Spock, by the needs of McCoy, by the crises with which he was faced at this turning point in his life, which happened for him to come in middle age. But in his youth, he was very much a by-the-book officer. He at one point describes himself as, I am a soldier. he describes himself that way. I believe in Errand of Mercy. He describes himself as a soldier.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting.
Has that same mindset in many ways as Pike does, because they have a lot in common at that stage. They're both young officers in their 30s. They're headstrong. They are the product of a very militaristic atmosphere that seems to have prevailed at the academy during their years when they were trained, as opposed to someone like Giorgio, who is the product of an older generation, maybe one that was less militaristic, or simply one that has been through so much hell that it has let go of those youthful illusions of immortality. It's let go of that youthful love of violence and war and glory, and has instead realized that there's more honor in finding a way not to fight.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a really good point.
Now, the book has been out for about 2 months. It's received positive reviews. I noticed after the mid-season finale of Star Trek Discovery, there was a surge of I need more Discovery all over social media. I'm hoping even more Trekkies are finding this book and it's on their radar. Now, the question I have for you, David, is, because of your connection to that writing room and because of your connection with Kirsten Bayer and the fact that she's in charge of the coordinating the series spinoff media products, is there a chance? Yes. Is there a chance that we're going to see potentially some of the things, the elements that we saw in Desperate Hours? Will we see some of these things actually find its way onto the series eventually? Now, I'm not telling you to give up the goods. I understand you probably signed 1,000 NDAs. However, can you say potentially that this is, even if this is not by definition a true canon novel, can we at least say that this is the closest canon novel?
It's really no closer to canon than any other novel. I hate to disappoint you.
I know.
It is a speculation. It's officially sanctioned, which means that it had to be approved not only by my editor and by the licensor at the CBS Television Products, and also by Kirsten, and also by the showrunners, by Gretchen Berg and Aaron Harberts.
Yep.
All these people signed off on the storyline for my book. And some efforts were made within the writer's room to remain consistent with the facts that I established, to the point where, although I won't name names, I know that somebody in the room at one point wanted to, or tried to, pitch a story to Gretchen and Aaron that would have involved incorporating Pike's Enterprise and Spock into a later episode dealing, you know, with something and having Michael and Spock interact.
Mm-hmm.
And Gretchen and Aaron had to tell that writer, you can't do it because that's actually the plot of the first novel and we've already approved it and it's through editing and it's gone. So that ship has sailed. We're sorry. That story has sailed. So there is some measure of respect within the room being shown to my book, some measure of deference trying not to torpedo my story, at least not until second season. As far as whether or not the show would cherry pick elements or details out of my book and incorporate them into the show, I have no idea. It could happen.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee that it will. No one has said that they won't. Now, if they do, that does not make the entire book canon. It would only canonize the specific elements or details that they choose to put in the show.
Yeah.
And again, I have no idea if they actually plan to do that or if anybody would. I'm sure if they were going to, or if it were being talked about, Kirsten Bayer would do her best to suggest it and suggest a good way to do it. And if they chose to do it, I'm pretty sure she would immediately call me or drop me an email and say, hey, guess what? But I've not heard that. As far as I know, that as far as the end of season one, that does not appear to be the case.
Yeah.
I know that the writer's room has been asked to convene this week to begin work on season two.
Really?
I don't know what their discussions are like at this stage. I don't know what they talk about this early in the process.
Right. Yes.
But I have no idea. They are perfectly within their rights to pluck any detail or element from my book that they want. The way it works is that the content of my book, I don't own it. Star Trek owns it. Star Trek owns the content of every Star Trek book, every Star Trek comic, every Star Trek short story. And so if at any point someone on the show saw something in one of the books that they liked and they wanted to cherry pick that and use it on the show, that's their right. They own it.
Yeah.
They can use any of it, and they don't have to pay us anything. So it's their property. They can do as they like with it.
Ultimately, it's a fun read because I like that they give you that background and that kind of that relationship between Burnham and Spock, and you kind of understand a bit. And even if it happens to not end up being canon, I feel like because it's sanctioned, at least the core elements of what makes Burnham tick and that relationship, at least I feel like it belongs there. Like they sanctioned it, they signed off on it. I'm like, okay. And that helps pacify me for the time while I'm watching the show. And because I know people have questions. I know a lot of the Star Trek Discovery fans on Twitter have questions about the Spock and Burnham connection, how it all plays out. And I quickly point to the book. I'm like, read the book. This book was signed off. It was sanctioned. At least there's something there to pacify us for now. And that's the fun aspect
of this book. They've already started to contradict me on a few small details. My ability to adjust my book to match what they were doing ends at about episode 8 or 9. That was the point at which when they were producing those scripts and those episodes, that was when my book went to press.
Okay.
Any episode produced after episode 9, anything that's in any of the episodes 10 through 15, at that point it was too late to change my book. And I will say that there were some details that came out later that directly contradict a few minor details in the back of my book. Also, there was one detail that's in my book. It's sort of like a deleted scene, if you will. It's in the mind meld sequence between Burnham and Spock, and you see the moment when Sarek brings Burnham back from her near-death experience after a bombing incident at the Vulcan Learning Center. And in all the scripts that I was working from, all the scripts for episode 2, that scene plays with both Sarek and Amanda being at Michael's side, and Amanda pleads with Sarek to use his psionic talents to bring Burnham back. And he has to caution her. He says, that would be very difficult. That'd be very dangerous. I don't know what that'll do to her or to me. And Amanda begs him. She says, please, you've got to do this. I'm begging you. And because she begs him, he does it. And that's how, you know, if you've seen the first half of the season,
right,
spoiler alert, this is how the Katra echo of Sarek winds up attached to Burnham's mind. This is how they wind up with this permanent psionic bond between them.
Yeah.
Is because he had to almost give up part of himself to restart her brain after she had clinically died during the bombing. Now, I wrote my scene in my version of that scene in the book to match what I had in the script. So I was tracking every change on that script.
Oh, man.
To make certain that there were no discontinuities. Imagine then my surprise when I see the finished episode and every trace of Amanda has been cut from the scene.
Oh, yeah.
She's physically not even there. In the finished version of the episode, she's not even there. For whatever reason, and you know, I don't ask because I'm not owed any explanations. It's right. Their show. But for some reason, in the editing process, when they were editing the episode, either to cut it down to a particular or desired running time, or for whatever reason, a decision was made to cut every last trace of Amanda out of that scene, I guess to make it play faster or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. But as a result, you know, the scene in my book does not play the same way as the scene in the episode. So if you've seen the episode and you want a little more texture or background of what was going on there, read the book and you get a fragment of a deleted scene.
Yeah.
It's funny you bring that up because, yeah, when I was reading that part of the book, I kind of pictured this as like a actual extra scene.
Yeah. There's so much backstory. I feel like this is forming an argument for canon novels. I mean, do you think the Star Trek franchise could benefit from something like what Star Wars is doing, where everything is connected, all iterations of Trek, whether it be comics, books, video games? Do you feel like something like that could work for Star Trek, or is it just an entirely different beast in terms of marketing?
It doesn't even work for Star Wars. Star Wars used to say that for years about all of its previous books. Oh, they're all canon. Oh, they're all approved by Lucasfilm. Yes, it all happened. Right up until the moment where it was no longer convenient. And then they slapped the Star Wars Legends banner on it. Went, that's not canon.
Yeah. That is very true.
Forget about those. Those are just legends. You know, they're not canon. These are canon, though. These new ones, these are canon. Until it's inconvenient, we decide these aren't canon and we change it. So it doesn't even work for Star Wars. And the truth is that the reason you're never going to see the canon label and that level of canon authority applied to media tie-in materials for Star Trek or really for any other franchise that knows what it's doing.
Yeah, it's definitely difficult.
Is that the tie-ins, even at their best and most popular, really only draw about 1% to 2% of the total audience that the parent product gets.
Really?
So in Next Gen, in its heyday, if it was getting 5 million viewers an episode, the readership was about 50,000. And you can't let the taste and interest of 50,000 readers dictate the creative choices that go into a show that costs millions of dollars of episodes to make and is seen by millions of people. At the end of the day, there's a lot more money involved in every episode of Star Trek Discovery than there is in the entire book publishing line across an entire year or even across multiple years. And there's a lot more pressure on the people who make those episodes.
Mm-hmm.
They have very little time in which to conceive of ideas, develop those ideas, execute them, budget them, get them into production, shoot them, edit them, and then distribute them. The whole process happens so fast and with such dizzying levels of overlap that to expect somebody operating under that degree of pressure to have to be worried about remaining consistent, not only with their own internal concepts, but also with hundreds, literally at this point, verging on close to 1,000 Star Trek novels, countless issues of comic books produced over 50 some odd years by multiple comic book publishers, video games, computer games, role-playing games. To expect these people to have that kind of encyclopedic knowledge and to craft their work to not contradict any of that other stuff is ridiculous.
Yeah.
They cannot produce the type of work they need to produce under the conditions they have to work and in the amount of time they have and with the budget they have. They are under enough pressure as it is.
Yeah.
They do not need the tail telling the dog how to do its job.
Yeah, that makes sense. You put up quite an argument. You won me over. No canon for Star Trek, only TV shows and movies. I'm on board now.
I knew the job was dangerous when I took it. I'm one of the fleas riding on the tail. I get it. I am not steering the ship here, and I get that.
Yeah.
I do what I'm told. I execute what I'm asked to execute. And, you know, if it works out great and there's some praise and plaudits involved, well, that's terrific. But, you know, I know I'm not the one setting the agenda.
Yeah.
My job is to put something out there that adds value to what the team on the show is doing. It is not my place to tell them how to do their jobs. And I have no expectation that they would ever, for a moment, worry about tailoring what they're doing to protect what I'm doing.
Right.
That's not how it works. That's just the job I was hired to do.
Yeah. All right. So let's switch gears a little bit here. Now, I want to talk about you personally a bit. Now, you majored in film and television production and screenwriting, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Because this next part is fantastic. If this is all true, you can tell me if some of this is incorrect. Now, the way I look at it is you had a plan, a drive. And this is what I said at the beginning of the interview with you, David, that I find very interesting. After college, you began writing spec scripts that you submitted to the producers of The Next Generation as well as Deep Space Nine, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, after several rejections, you finally sold a script to Star Trek Voyager. Story that was never produced. But then shortly after, correct, you sold another script to Deep Space Nine, which was produced, Starship Down.
Right.
Now, this episode to this day is critically acclaimed, correct? Like, it finds itself on a lot of lists of top episodes of Deep Space Nine. Now,
no, that's not correct.
That's not
the
correct.
The one that frequently makes it onto list of favorites is the season 7 episode, It's Only a Paper Moon.
Okay.
On which I and John J. Ordover share the story credit. And the teleplay credit goes to Ron Moore.
Okay. All right. So I have to go slap my research department because they fed me wrong information, apparently.
Well, I mean, Starship Down was, you know, my breakthrough. Was Don and I got the written by credit. And in a way, I mean, it was a triumph for us, especially for me as a young writer at the time. When that sold, I was 25. When we did the script, I was 26. And the way that came about was our first phone pitch was with Voyager, as you noted. Mm-hmm. And off of that first phone pitch meeting, we sold a story idea to Jeri Taylor. She really loved one of our pitches and thought it would be great. So she said, well, let's make a deal for that. And John and I, before we did any of these pitch meetings, because we wanted to be ready to take on a script assignment if we were that lucky, mm-hmm. we had practiced executing the scripts in the 2-week delivery timeline that freelancers had to work under at that time.
Right.
And so when we made the story sale to Jeri Taylor at Voyager, John asked her, he said, well, we have a spec script, a Deep Space Nine spec script that shows what we're capable of. Can we send it over to you as a writing sample to see if you think we're good enough to have a script assignment? And she said, sure, that'd be fine. I can look at a DS9 script. No problem. I can't look at a Voyager script, but I can look at a DS9. So we sent her our DS9 spec script, Crown of Iron. And it was a fun little thing, sort of inspired by Highlander with its visual transitions between the past and the present. And it was our take of a Bajoran interpretation of the Jewish story of Masada. Hmm. And so we had cast the Cardassians as the Romans and the Bajorans as the Jews. And we came up with the name of a fortress and yada, yada. So we sent her this script. And she loves it. She flipped for it. And at that time, both Voyager and DS9's offices were in the Hart building on the Paramount lot. Mm-hmm. So word spreads quickly. If you make a sale at the Voyager office and then about a week later on another phone call, we made two potential sales to DS9.
Amazing.
Word starts to spread quickly in the Hart building of freelancers who've made 3 sales in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So she walked downstairs and she walked into Iris Stephen Bear's office with a copy of our script. And she said, I heard you bought at least one story from Mac and Ordover. And he says, that's right. And she handed him our spec script. And she said, I've read their spec. It's really good. I know it's for your show, but read it anyway. You may want to give them a script assignment.
That's fantastic.
And so Jeri Taylor went to bat for us, and Ira read the script. And apparently he was impressed enough with what he read that even though this was my and John's first sale to television of any kind, we got the script assignment. We got to write the teleplay, and we got the written by credit, which is very rare for freelancers on their first sale.
Yeah, that's just such a fascinating story. I love success stories like that because you worked your ass off. You wrote your scripts, and then from there, you kind of solidified your career as a writer because shortly after, you earned that official invitation, correct, to write your own full-length Star Trek novel. Is that around the same time period?
No, actually, those two events happened about
6-7 years
apart.
Yeah.
8 years apart. Ah, I see.
The first sales to Voyager and DS9 occurred in 1995. The pitch meetings happened around February of 95. And March of 95, give or take. And the break session for our first episode was in August of 95. And the episode Starship Down aired in November of 95. By contrast, the invitation to write my first full-length novel, that didn't happen until 2003.
Really?
In between, there was a lot of other stuff. John and I worked on a lot of, we did a lot of spec script work. Mm-hmm. During the 90s, most of it came to naught. We did well over 100 pitches. We pitched well between like 100 and 150 different stories.
Wow.
To DS9 and Voyager, and we never sold again. After that initial burst of luck in 95, we never hit again.
Yeah.
Just didn't get that lucky. What I was doing at the time, now I was deep in debt with student loans, thanks to film school and living in New York and credit card debt and whatnot.
Yeah.
So everything I earned went to paying off my debts. And when I wasn't pitching scripts, I was writing freelance articles for magazines. Yep. I was a freelance journalist. I was a reporter at one point, did the crime beat here in New York City. I worked for computer magazines, lifestyle magazines, music magazines, entertainment magazines, sports magazines, game day sports program publishers, worked for restaurant and food service news publications. And so I worked for pretty much everybody. You know, I was either an editor working in offices, or I was a freelance writer, and I would write freelance articles. And the other way I was making money was through the Pocket Books office. They were still are the right. Star Trek Books publisher.
Yeah.
John was an editor at Star Trek Books. That was how he had the contact for us to get the pitch meetings. Through John, I would take work, you know, editorial scut work around the office. I would read slush manuscripts and find reasons to reject them and write up the rejection memos. I got paid pretty much by the pound. So the bigger the manuscript I got off their shelf, the more I got paid. So I was hauling reams of paper back and forth from the Star Trek Books office to my apartment, and reading them and writing slush, you know, memo reports and whatever. And so I was doing that work. I was writing reference materials for other Star Trek authors who were working at that time. People like Michael Jan Friedman, Peter David, John Bornholt, Greg Cox. I would write, like, for instance, you know, they would need reference materials to keep track of original characters that they had created for ongoing series, all of which had started with Peter David and New Frontier.
Yeah.
And then there were others like Stargazer and whatnot. And so I was writing all this, you know, reference material, helpful material, crap like that. And then one day, I think it was late 90s, can't remember if this was before or after It's Only a Paper Moon, which happened in 1998 or 1999. I can't remember. I think it's 98. At some point around then, John Bornholt came up short on a manuscript, Genesis Wave Book 1, I believe it was. He was late, and his manuscript was short of publishable length. And they came to me on a Friday afternoon and said, can you, in 72 hours, write 5,000 words in the format of a classified Starfleet military report about the Genesis device?
Jesus.
About being a cool wife. I said, of course I can. Watch me do it.
There you go.
So I went away and I spent the whole week, working on this thing, and I wrote it up in four parts. I wrote a military report from the time of its detonation. I wrote a diplomatic report. I wrote some other technical thing. Then I wrote a follow-up that was written many decades later. So it looked like a series of internal memoranda of either a scientific, a political, a strategic nature or whatever. But in fact, they tell the behind-the-scenes story that sets up everything that's going on with the Genesis device in John's novel. So I do this. Technically, I don't have any credit on it. They didn't know what they were going to do with it. They thought at first they might slap it into the back of the book as an appendix. Then they thought they might put it at the front of the book as a foreword. But what they eventually ended up doing is it became chapter 14. And John Bornholt very helpfully and very graciously wrote a framing sequence around it to incorporate it into his book. And the editors there was an editor's note that was added to the back of the book that credited me for the work. Because I had done that and turned it around in 72 hours, they came to me sometime later, maybe a year later, with a project, the Starfleet Survival Guide.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we have this idea. It's already approved. It has an artist. It just needs a writer. And they said it's like the worst case scenario survival handbook, but for crap that would only happen to you in the Star Trek universe. We need a writer. Do you want to write it? Not being a fool, I said, let me get this straight. The book is already approved. I don't have to pitch the book. The idea is already greenlit. You just need someone to write it and take a check. Yes, I think I could do that. So I take the gig. I write this book. It's not really narrative fiction, but, you know, it played to my strength, which at the time was I knew Star Trek technobabble.
Yeah.
Like nobody at the time knew Star Trek technobabble. But, and I knew Star Trek history and continuity. So I wrote this thing. I turned it in. And as John put it, I says, okay, you've proved you can finish a whole book. We have a new line of Star Trek ebooks that we're producing, Star Trek Corps of Engineers. And, you know, we're publishing an ebook novella, you know, new every month. We need to get people in the pipeline and get this thing going. Would you like to write some of these? I said, sure, why not? You know, it's money and it's a chance to get into it. So
right.
I teamed up with my buddy Keith DeCandido, and he was the editor on the line along with John. They were co-editors. And Keith and I co-wrote a two-part story called Invincible, which were installments 7 and 8 of this monthly series. And I enjoyed it enough that I wanted to come back and do another, and I had written up my outline for another two-parter called Wildfire. And in between when I pitched it and when it was time to go to work on it, the seminal event that happened was 9/11. And at the time 9/11 happened, I was working at the Sci-Fi Channel in Rockefeller Center, and I got to stand on 6th Avenue and watch the towers come down. Mm. And something about that day just changed my outlook, and I ended up calling up my editors, a few weeks later after the dust had settled. And I said, I've been thinking about Wildfire. I know that the writing on that has to start pretty soon. And I said to Keith, I know we had talked about collaborating on this the way we collaborated on Invincible, but I feel like now there are things that I would really like to say in this story.
Right.
And I would like it to be in my own words. How would you feel about me tackling this one solo? Would you be okay with that? And Keith, God love him. This is why he's one of my best friends. He said, I think that's a fantastic idea. Let me know if you need any help, any advice, if there's anything I can do. Just let me know. But he says, I think you're going to knock this out of the park. Vaya con Dios, good luck. And he sent me on my way. So Wildfire, if you put the two novellas together, they're the length of a short novel. And that was sort of my solo fiction narrative prose debut. And that came out sometime around January of 2003. And it was on the strength of that. That, at the time, got lots of great reviews. Sadly, most of them seem to have been lost to antiquity, but I preserved some of them on my website. But I mean, it got great reviews, and it was essentially a tragedy. It was a heartbreaker of a story where I kill off like half the crew. And it's like one of those, the ship goes into one of those suicide mission disasters, you know, the kind that you always have in Star Trek, and then everybody miraculously walks away.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. This time they don't miraculously walk away. Right. Half the crew winds up dead. The captain loses a hand. The male lead romantic love interest of the main character is killed.
Wow.
I mean, it's just an unapologetic tragedy. I mean, the crew basically gets the shit beat out of them. Pardon my French. And it was on the strength of that and the reviews that that got. That was when John Ordover came to me a few months later and said, we've been working on this 9-book series that we're going to publish next year, which we're tentatively calling A Time To. It's based off the Ecclesiastes verses, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to live, a time to, et cetera. And he said, we had a writer drop out of doing book 7 and 8. Book 7 and 8 are up for grabs. It's late enough in the process that there's still time to sub somebody in. Would you be willing to jump on this gig and write 2 back-to-back full-length paperback novels? He says, we'd need them pretty fast because they, you know, we have to have them no later than, sometime after the new year if they're going to come out next fall. And I said, of course.
If it was,
of course I can do that.
If it was more than 72 hours.
Ridiculous, because at the time I just gotten engaged. I was moving out of an apartment I'd lived in for 12 years. Everything you can imagine on every type of stress you can possibly throw on top of somebody at once all got thrown on top of me. And somehow I still finished those 2 books. And that was my first full length paperback novel was A Time to Kill, and followed a month later by A Time to Heal. And A Time to Heal made the USA Today bestseller list.
Yeah.
And based on the very strong reviews those got and the very strong sales that both enjoyed, they have continued to hire me to write books ever since.
Yeah.
And since those 2, I have just, I've written 27 Star Trek novels. My 27th Star Trek novel is in fact published today.
Yep.
November 28th. As we speak, today marks the release of my Star Trek Titan novel, Fortune of War. And that is my 27th full-length Star Trek novel that I've written.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing.
That is amazing.
And I am very partial to the storyline for that book, Star Trek Titan Fortune of War. And I was very excited when your publisher sent me a review copy and said, hey, this comes out the day of your review. Here's a copy. Sent it right to me. And I mean, it's dealing with the Next Generation era with Riker. And it's post-Nemesis, about 20 years, I believe, afterwards. So that book is available now, Star Trek Titan, Fortune of War. Check it out. How long does it usually take?
Well, it's not 20 years after It's not 20 years after Nemesis.
Oh, it's not.
It's 20 years after the episode The Survivors, which was a third season episode of Star Trek TNG. So it takes place around late 2386, which is about 7 years after Nemesis.
Seven years. Okay. Yeah. I like it. Nothing wrong with some more Will Riker stories, that's for sure. Now, really fast, I've noticed, and I may be off, have you written anything within the Kelvin timeline as of yet?
I have, but it wasn't published.
Okay.
There was a four-book series that was supposed to be based on the Bad Robot films. The books were commissioned in 2009 and were set to be published in 2010. And of those four books, I wrote one. Chris Farrell Bennett wrote another. One was by Greg Cox, and the last was by Alan Dean Foster. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the order was on the release. I think Alan Dean Foster's book may have been the first one to go. I think I was in the number two spot, and then behind me were Greg and Christopher. All four books were written. They had all been through, at the very least, copy editing, I think. My book was laid out. It had been copy edited. It had been designed. I think we even had tentative cover art. So we were very close to being ready to go to press. I think Alan Dean Foster's book was just about to go on press. Various disagreements happened behind the scenes between the team at Bad Robot, team at CBS, the team at Simon & Schuster. And however it shook out, whatever the particulars of the behind the scenes events were, the result was that Simon & Schuster ended up having to pull those four books.
Okay.
And I think that the other writers, either their books are now so wildly out of track with the continuity that came afterward with Into Darkness and Star Trek Beyond,
right,
that their manuscripts are not salvageable, or in the case of one or two, and I'm not going to say who, but some of them salvaged narrative bits from their books and repurposed them in other novels later on.
Okay.
Of those four books, I think mine is the only one. I never went back and salvaged it for parts, as they say.
Right.
Because I wrote a story that was so specific to that universe and that version of the characters and that version of their lives that I could not simply transplant that story to any other iteration of Star Trek or any other set of characters. It was so specific to that setting that I couldn't mine it for parts. So it's just sitting there. And I think I've heard rumors that if and when the Star Trek guys get their book line going again one of these days and start announcing new titles, there has been some rumor that my book, which is titled More Beautiful Than Death, might actually get resurrected. That's not confirmed. Okay. I've not seen it on a schedule. Nobody has confirmed this to me. I've only heard the rumors. I've heard that they're talking about it.
Well, let's hope.
My book may yet see the light of day.
Yeah, let's hope it does.
Having been pulled from the schedule over 7 years ago, it may yet see the light of day.
Let's hope.
Well, now, let's get controversial then. Since we're on this topic, David, I know it's such a hot-button topic amongst Trekkies. What are your general thoughts in a nutshell on the Kelvin timeline, JJ's iterations of Star Trek?
Well, you're really trying to put me on the hot seat here, aren't you? You're trying to get me fired. No, as I said before, obviously it's a very different take on Star Trek. He had to reimagine it to be more effective in the feature film marketplace.
Yeah. Yep.
And feature films, by their nature, especially when you're dealing with large scale, big budget science fiction.
Right.
The audiences are primed to react well to fast paced action adventure with big effects, large scale action destruction. And so he very astutely and, what's the word I'm looking for here? Whatever it was, he had a good enough business sense to realize that was what was going to sell.
Right.
And obviously, those movies have been more successful at the box office than almost all of their previous Star Trek kin.
Yeah.
So I can't fault his acumen on the business side. And for instance, the first, I think of the three movies, I think I like the third one the best, just because to me it feels the most Star Trek, while at the same time preserving that sense of action and momentum.
I would agree.
After that, and after that, I liked the first movie, the 2009 feature just called Star Trek. I really enjoyed that one. I realized that there are numerous things in it that are, let's say, violations of scientific logic. certain things don't make any scientific sense. Even the understanding of the fictional Star Trek technology at times in that movie is way, way off. But that's not what matters. Right. That's not a movie that you appreciate with your head. That's a movie to be appreciated with the heart. And I got to admit, the first time I saw that movie, the fact that it opens with, you know, this exciting moment, you've got the Kelvin, you've got the Narada.
Yeah.
And the fact that its opening sequence is George Kirk, you know, last man on the bridge, and his last act in life is to name his son before he dies.
Yeah.
Man, talk about grabbing you by the heart.
Yep.
You know, sticking the knife in and twist it. The thing is, it's such a gut-wrenching, primal thing, and it works. And it's so emotionally effective.
Absolutely.
After that opening sequence, I was like, all right, no matter what you do at this point, I am in. I am along for the ride.
Yeah.
I'm going to forgive you just about anything at this point because you've gotten to me at the heart. You've gotten my emotions, and that's what's important in that form of storytelling.
Yeah.
And then they did it to me again in the middle of the movie when Spock loses his mother.
Yep.
And that is heartbreaking. It is a devastating moment to have that happen, to lose Vulcan, but then specifically to lose Amanda the way that they do.
Yep.
Is just a heartbreaking thing. And so the movie, although it doesn't always work, you know, up in the brain, it works so well in the heart. That movie has such tremendous heart that I forgive it a lot of gaps in logic and science.
I agree.
Second movie, let's just not talk about it.
See, Dave, we're on the same page. You're the last 3 minutes. It sounds exactly like David and I when we're talking on our show. That you explained it exactly the way we do, and the exact same feelings. And we say the same thing about Into Darkness. Like, let's pretend that one didn't exist.
Let's pretend it.
Let's Highlander 2 this and pretend it just doesn't exist. Let's get it out of there. Like it was. I don't know what they were thinking.
Yeah.
But all right, a few more questions and then we're going to wrap this up really fast. I have to get your favorite Star Trek series. Give me your rank. Give me your rank from least to favorite.
Now, we're talking only about the canonical TV series,
just the TV series. Yes. Correct. And you can and exclude Discovery
TV series,
exclude Discovery because it's too new.
Too new. All right.
Yeah.
Of the five previous, if we're going to count animated series in there.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. Most definitely.
Okay. I guess I'd have to go. Deep Space Nine is far and away my favorite, not just because I wrote for it, but because I have so much respect for what they accomplished artistically.
David and I are going to be best friends.
Bringing serialized narrative to Star Trek.
Yep.
Darkening the moral and ethical palette of Star Trek while remaining true to the ethos of the universe. So DS9 is definitely my number one.
I think you might be my twin brother.
It's very true.
I'm torn as to whether I want to put TOS or TNG in the number two spot because they both have a rightful claim to it. The problem is that TOS, although today to modern audiences it feels dated, it's camp, it's kitschy in some regards, and some of its sexual politics are, to be honest, deplorable. and some of its racial politics aren't too much better. It is a seminal work without which the rest of the universe would not exist. And it's only three seasons as opposed to the seven of TNG, but the first two and a half seasons of TNG are awful. So I'm going to have to go TOS just because it is so seminal and without which nothing else would have existed. It has to have my number two spot.
Okay.
TNG goes to number three.
All right.
Because there was so much to love. Once they found their footing, they were, you know, truly remarkable.
Agreed.
And then beyond that, now I guess I'm going to have to, you know, ruffle a few feathers here. I'm going to go animated series on number four.
Yeah. Well, really?
Just for the sheer fun and the joy of it. As brief a blip in the continuity as it was, and the fact that it was only semi-canon for so much of its existence, and to some degree still is. I'm still putting that at number four.
Wow. Ballsy move there, Dave.
I'm torn then as to whether to put Voyager or Enterprise in the last spot. The last two spots. It's a battle to the a race to the bottom, a battle for last place. Which one do I find more bothersome? Voyager or Enterprise? I'm going to go Voyager at number five. And the reason it beats out Enterprise is because at one point they actually bought a story from me. So I'm going to put Voyager at number five.
That's a good reason.
I'm going to dump Enterprise to the back of the bench.
It's funny that basically you bring up the fact that Enterprise is always on the back of the bench because like every Star Trek fan constantly puts Enterprise dead last when it comes to every series.
And I'm torn with Enterprise because I feel like the last two seasons were really solid, but I think it was too late. I know I'm in the minority when I say the last two seasons were solid. But if I had to,
I haven't watched much of the last two seasons. I watched enough of the first season to get fed up and decide I was never going to watch any more of it. Between the opening music, the cheesy sets, and I think what really killed Enterprise for me was that at the time I was working at the Sci-Fi Channel when Enterprise debuted, and I was comparing it to programming that the Sci-Fi Channel was producing at that time.
Yeah.
Some of these shows, like, I was comparing it to Stargate SG-1 and to Farscape. Mm-hmm. And although those two series look dated by today's standards, at the time, they were at least trying to do something different, something unique. They had more personality, more texture. They were light on their feet. They were the new young hotshot kids in the sci-fi TV universe, and they made Enterprise look like a stodgy high school play with bad production value.
I can't disagree.
I remember looking at Enterprise and just saying, I can see the grain in the plywood flat. What are you people doing?
I can't disagree because I actually rewatched the pilot recently, and I tweeted this out, and it got a lot of responses that were positive for my opinion. And I was like, you know what? The pilot is okay. It's not as bad as I remember it. However, just the production value and the CGI does not hold up at all. I mean, you watch episodes of Enterprise even before they remastered it, not Enterprise, TNG, even before they remastered it. And same thing with Deep Space Nine, and the use of miniatures and the practical effects holds up to this date. You know, up to this day, it holds up. But then you watch the CGI, the schlocky CGI in Enterprise, and you just want to pull your hair out. And you're like, wow, this is not fun. Yeah.
Although they did start using some second-rate CGI near the end on DS9.
Yeah.
And that is among many other reasons part of why you're never going to really see a high-def update of DS9, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, unfortunately. Now, last question, and I think it's the most important question of this entire interview, David, and it is Deanna Troi, DePaul, or Seven of Nine.
What regard? Is this like are we talking like a kiss, marry, kill type of thing, or what?
I'll make it simple. Just if you had to choose one to go out on a date, a nice dinner, Deanna Troi, DePaul, or Seven of Nine. Come on, let's get childish here before we send you off. Let's end this intelligent conversation we've had in a childish manner.
It's better than the argument, you know, which captain do you choose?
Exactly. Forget the captains.
Everyone asks that.
Forget the captains. Let's focus on Deanna Troi, DePaul, and Seven of Nine. It's all right.
Let's just get Ezri Dax and go get milkshakes.
There you go.
You know what? I'm for milkshakes, David.
I stand up all three of them, and I take Ezri Dax out for a milkshake.
Okay.
There you go.
I can get behind that one. All right, David. Thank you so much. Being gracious and being here for the last hour, I appreciate it. And I wish you the best of luck on your new novel, Star Trek Titan. It is amazing. Fortune of War. Go get it, people, now, and also Desperate Hour.
And folks, if you've enjoyed my work for Star Trek and other franchises over the years, at the end of January in 2018, January 30th, is the release of a book called The Midnight Front. It is the first book in my new original series called Dark Arts, being published by Tor Books. It is contemporary fantasy. It's set in World War II. The big idea is that the Nazis had sorcerers working for them, so the Allies decide they need to have some sorcerers of their own. And we follow a young American named Cade Martin. His family is killed at the outset of the Second World War. On a mission of revenge, he gets himself recruited into the Midnight Front, which is the Allies' top secret magical warfare program.
Awesome. You just won me over. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
And it's the start of a new series. I just finished writing book two, Codex, and that's going to be a spy thriller set in the Cold War in 1954. And very soon I begin work on book three, The Shadow Commission, which is going to be a conspiracy thriller set in 1963, right after the Kennedy assassination.
Oh, man.
Nice.
Diverse genres there. I like it.
The idea is that every book in the series is going to be a different style of book.
Oh, really?
That's cool. I like that. I'm looking forward to seeing it. And that's out in January, you said?
January 30th, The Midnight Front.
All right.
Tour books.
All right. Visit official website, davidmack.pro, and follow him on Twitter, David Allen Mack. Thank you, David. Have a great afternoon.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Bye. All right. So both Star Trek Discovery, Desperate Hours, and Star Trek Titan, Fortune of War is out now. If you did not catch that, I think we all got a very, very excited towards the end of the interview, David. I feel like
I'm really excited about that one series. I mean, I'm a sucker for World War II books.
Yeah. And it took about 40 minutes for all of us to get cohesively on the same page. And then it's like, wow, we got to end in 20 minutes. That's usually what happens with interviews, like where you barely get the flow going because we're all, for the most part, right, Dave, we're complete strangers with David.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we only know him by Twitter and his writing. He doesn't know us at all. So it takes time to get everything flowing. And by the time we feel good and we're all synced up, it's time to say goodbye.
It's funny that basically, though, that his ranking of the Star Trek series in general pretty much matched ours, except for Deep Space Nine. I'm not going to put it number one.
That matched mine. That matched mine.
It matched yours.
Yeah. Maybe not yours.
But like the fact that.
Do you see his reasoning, though?
Yeah, I see his reasoning.
It's his sound reasoning. And his reasoning on the Calvin timeline makes a lot of sense. It's exactly what we say.
It makes complete sense.
They designed these movies to save Star Trek. So his reasoning was sound. They needed to have a box office success.
And he's right. I mean, the third movie feels more like a Star Trek episode than anything else.
Yeah.
And I'm glad he brought up the fact that the reason why a lot of people, including myself, actually do like the first J.J. Abrams films, it's not because it's a Star Trek film. It's because it tugs on that nostalgic heart that we all liked.
All right. So for more Star Trek Discovery discussions, head over to RainmanDigitalMedia.com. Also, if you want more Star Trek discussions from us from a vast array of topics, head over to Patreon.com/RainmanDigital, where we get into all types of things. The Borg, Mirror Universe, the original series, Q. Yeah, that's right, Q. So patreon.com/RainmanDigital. And thank you, everybody, for listening today.
Live long and prosper.
This has been a Rain Man Spotlight interview with your host, Michael Flores. For all things Rain Man, visit and bookmark www.rainmandigitalmedia.com.